Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with best-selling author James Lee Burke, whose new Dave Robichaux novel is The New Iberia Blues. It's always a great pleasure to talk with James Lee Burke. He's written 37 novels and 2 short story collections over his long and distinguished career, and he's deservedly recognized as a grandmaster by the Mystery Writers of America. Not to mention the fact that he is beloved by Louisiana readers and received the Louisiana Writer Award at the Louisiana Book Festival in 2002. Today, we're celebrating the arrival of this 22nd novel featuring Cajun detective Dave Robichaux. It's called The New Iberia Blues, and it is a showstopper. Jim Burke, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Well, thank you for having me on the show again, Susan. I appreciate it.
It's always so good to hear your voice and to see it on the page. I was reading this book, and I was so caught up in the plot, turning those pages, and all I could think of was, thanks, Jim. I mean, another twisted tale.
Well, I think it may be the best in the series.
I might not fight you on that, actually. Now, in The New Iberia Blues, Dave gets involved with a case of a murdered woman, Lucinda Arsenault, who's crucified and left floating in the water. And as typically happens, one thing leads to another, until we find possible suspects among movie folks who are filming an epic work in New Iberia. So what is it about the movies that draws you? This isn't the first time we've seen that bad influence of Hollywood on the bayou.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I've always thought that the movie industry is America's secular cathedral. And the peculiarity is that people demean it constantly. And people always talk about, they use the word Hollywood as a pejorative.
Mm-hmm.
But we elect actors to national office, including the White House, the presidency.
That's true.
Have governors who were former actors, you know, very popular guys. But the point is, in this book, I make use of the legendary film director, John Ford, and
yes,
his work. And Dave refers to the story he's narrating as our Manichaean tale of the struggle between good and evil, light and darkness. You know, so that's the backdrop, the work of John Ford. But more importantly, the book is meant as an allegory. The previous Robichaux novel, titled Robichaux, is part of a trilogy, the first book of a trilogy, Robichaux, and then this book, and the third one I'm writing now. They can be read separately.
Mm-hmm.
The storyline is, each is independent of the other, but it's meant to be a statement, an allegorical statement about the era in which we find ourselves today.
And one of the things that I admired about this book is that Dave acknowledges that, and you acknowledge, of course, that the movies are capable of being epic creations, that they give us these haunting images that stay with us for life.
That's right. Yeah, that's it. They're films you never forget. And one of which is My Darling Clementine.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody ever forgets the last scene in that motion picture when Henry Fonda in the buggy says goodbye to Clementine Carter. I saw it in 1946. I never forgot it. And
wow.
That one is the last scene in Shane.
Yes, yep.
You know, the screen, A.B. Guthrie wrote that screenplay, the same man who wrote The Way West and The Big Sky.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, you remember those things all these years. Well, you're right. Nobody ever forgets them. That's true. Now, as violence is examined in this novel, it illuminates this web of family violence and loss, all kinds of political corruption. I mean, I feel like sometimes Dave shows us this dark kind of net all over the world that stretches from foreign movie financiers to parents who give up their children to people who are enacting vigilante justice and to the, you know, the prison system. Everything. He sees the darkness everywhere.
Well, he does, but I don't think that it's a misrepresentation. The history of the human race, it's soaked with blood. But the reality is, every journalist knows this, anybody who's ever been a police reporter, people who work in penal institutions know this, cops know it. There's stories that none of them will ever repeat to anyone. It's just too awful, the things that a person never wants to remember. It's why a lot of the people I just mentioned have problems with prescriptions and booze.
Mm-hmm.
I remember somebody once asked me a question at a signing, and I had written something, and it was something about Angola prison. And the person said, well, don't you feel that's exaggerated, something like that. And I said, no, it's understated. And I'll never talk about what I saw when I worked in there. I did folk recording many years ago with the inmates and had access to all the camps. And I just won't talk about it. I guess I have to a few people, but I know what they did in there. I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
The things they did were, I don't want to talk about it, but it just depressed people. The cruelty.
Yeah, yeah.
The violence. Oh, geez. This was 1961. I'm sure it's a better place than it was back then, but it's pretty bad. You know,
yeah.
The inhumanity was of a kind that is without a doubt pathological, and it was institutionalized. The point is, this isn't a Judeo-Christian culture. Look, think of it this way. Do you remember the name of Willie Francis?
Mm-hmm, of course.
12-year-old black kid who killed a druggist, the pharmaceutical guy, in St. Martinville and was sent to the electric chair. He was electrocuted twice. He didn't die the first time because the two executioners were drunk, and he had to be resuscitated, healed, and then he was electrocuted a second time. He was 12 years old when he committed the murder, and no one's quite sure why. There's some overtones that are not good at all. But this was done in, whew, golly, I don't know, it was 1947, 48, back then, 10 miles from New Iberia, my family home.
People have written entire books about Willie Francis.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And his lawyer appealed to the governor, Jimmy Davis, the man who wrote You Are My Sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
He appealed to Davis for clemency, and Davis refused to let the second execution go forward. And you know, you can tell people that story, that probably they don't believe it, but it happened in my lifetime.
Yeah. But yet, Dave is still open to hope. And I think in this book, he's feeling these intimations of mortality.
Yeah.
He's contemplating eternity. And he sees what an impressive young woman his daughter, Alifair, has become, you know, a lawyer, a novelist, much like your own Alifair.
Uh-huh.
And he becomes involved with a young woman named Bailey Ribbons.
Yeah.
That gift for names, you got it.
You know what I mean? That name, isn't it? But she steps out of history for Dave. She walks out of John Ford's picture and becomes Clementine Carter in the year 2018. Yeah.
And I say, every time he says, I love your name,
yeah,
I thought, That's Jim talking.
Yes, it's also the last line in My Darling Clementine. The film ends, and Henry Fonda is about to ride away. He knows there are no adequate words. He'll never see Clementine again, but he takes off his hat and says, Clementine, oh, I love that name, Clementine.
Oh.
That's the last line in the film. What a film. Golly, Moses. It's just sends chills all over me still. You see the background. Look out into the wasteland. That's Monument Valley. And you see this huge butte that looks just like a tombstone. That's how it is.
Amazing. Yeah, just amazing.
Great director.
Well, one of the things I love about the New Iberia Blues is that as Dave gets older, he has this sense of what endures and what changes and what falls away, and memories endure. And there's this wonderful passage that captures one of Dave's best memories. And I wonder if you'd read it for us.
Oh, well, swell. I just happen to have a copy by one of my favorite writers. Okay, hang on. I got to get my glasses on.
Oh, I know that feeling.
Okay, I got it right here. All righty, here we are.
All right.
Okay. All right, Dave is referring here to a place, a tree, a big live oak or spreading oak, on the banks of Bayou Teche in New Iberia. And he has been seriously affected by depression. And he reminisces on an incident that occurred when he and his father went fishing there under that tree right after World War II. My father could not read or write and barely spoke English, but he understood the natural world and the culture of Bayou Teche. To us, the bayou was not simply a tidal stream that knitted together what we call Acadiana. It was part of a biblical epic, and because of its mist and fog-shrouded swamps, a magical place inhabited by lamias and leprechauns and medieval tricksters and voodoo women and the spirits of Confederate soldiers and cannibalistic Attakapaw Indians. It was a grand place to grow up. The day I threw my line into the water, I knew I would never leave Bayou Teche, in part because of the event that occurred as a result of my father buying the cane pole from a colored man. The bobber had been carved from a piece of balsa wood and drilled with a hole into which a shaved stick was inserted to secure the line. I saw the bobber tremble once, then plunge straight down into the silt. I jerked the pole so hard I broke it in half, and the line and bobber and lead bullet and hook and worm and a big green gold goggle-eyed perch went flying into a tree limb above it. My father went to the Burke house and borrowed a garden rake and combed the fish out of the tree for me. I still suspect this may be the only time in history that a fish has been caught in a live oak tree with the garden rake. This postage stamp of a moment has always remained with me as a reminder of the innocent world in which I grew up, or at least the innocent world in which we chose to live, perhaps to our regret. When I sat under the tree at 3 a.m, an old man watching a barge and tug working its way upstream, I knew that I no longer had to reclaim the past, that the past was still with me, inextricably part of my soul and who I was. I could step through a hole in the dimension and be with my father and mother again, and I didn't have to drink or mourn the dead or live on a cross for my misdeed. I was set free in the past and the future, and the present were at the ends of my fingertips, filled with promise and goodness, and I didn't have to submit to time or fate or even mortality. The party is a grand one and infinite in nature, and like the music of the spheres, thunderous in its presence. And I realized finally that the invitation to it comes with the sunrise and a clear eye and a good heart and the knowledge that we're already inside it, eternity, and need not fear it any longer. I drove home, but that's it.
Oh, Jim, I love that. I thought that was the most beautiful part of the book for me.
Thank you.
Oh, goodness. Now, one of the great things Dave says in this book, and I know it's true because I feel it myself, he's talking about two of the characters, and he says, they came from the Louisiana I loved, and I love Louisiana in the same way you love a religion. You don't care if your obsession is rational, and you're not bothered that your love is partly erotic. Is he speaking for you there?
Sure. But he's more eloquent than I. He's more eloquent.
Then I don't know about that. He must be just such a pleasure to keep company with.
Well, Dave's a great character. You know, he's the everyman figure from the medieval morality plays. And I think for that reason, he is a popular protagonist, narrator in American crime novels. And I call them crime novels, but I think that essentially, you know, all art that aspires to something of a historic story has to incorporate the underside of society. I mean, really, history, the historical account, deals more with the underside of society rather than figures who were emblematic of a very small group of people. As Steinbeck said that, individuals do not shape history. History reaches out for symbols. Hitler did not give us Nazism. You know, he was selected by his time, and it's a terrible time in Germany when people wanted a scapegoat and they found this fellow, you know, to be their leader.
Well, you know, I keep having to remind people that you were born in Houston. You know what I mean? Because everybody assumes, I mean, you are one of the greatest of Louisiana writers, and yet you were born in Houston and you don't live here and haven't lived here for quite a while now.
Well, we left Louisiana we sold our house just a few years back. But I've been around there all my life. So anywhere between Houston and New Orleans, it's where I grew up.
Well, I'm glad I'm glad Louisiana is still a muse for you.
But anyway, this book follows the previous book, Robichaux. So, and this third one is, I hope, you know, will be as good as the two earlier ones. But I'm proud of the way the books have turned out. And it was just by chance that I wrote the first one because I was out. I'd been out of print 13 years. You know,
I remember that.
A friend of mine said that's like being rich twice and going broke three times.
I remember that time, the first time I interviewed you, you said you talked about how editors in New York had sent back your manuscripts as if they'd been thrown across the room.
Oh, geez, and the catapult.
Yep.
Boogie was rejected 111 times.
Yeah.
Submission for 9 years.
But you said then this great thing. You said if you just keep swinging, you'd be surprised at the numbers that end up on the board.
That's right.
Thou always took that as great advice for all writers. You know what I mean? Oh, man. Well, we've been talking with that great Louisiana writer, James Lee Burke. His new Dave Robichaux novel, The New Iberia Blues, is just out. Don't miss it. Jim, thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you, Susan. I really appreciate it.
Libraries have always been part of our family life, especially our family travels. When we first moved to New Orleans, my 3-year-old daughter Casey and I went to Ladder Library every week in a sweltering August. Thank goodness for their air conditioning. When my son Dash and I evacuated for Katrina, we often went to the library in Richardson, Texas for help. On a trip to New York, we never missed the Morgan Library, especially at Christmas time, when visitors can see a first edition of Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. It's always fun to visit those regal, statuesque lions, patience, and fortitude in front of the New York Public Library, and see the statue of Gertrude Stein in Bryant Park. One of my late husband's most treasured possessions was his reader's card for the Bodleian Library in Oxford, which I still have. So, on a recent trip to Providence, Rhode Island to visit my son, we toured libraries. 4 amazing ones. One of the oldest libraries I've ever been in is the Providence Athenaeum, founded in 1831 and incorporated into its present form in 1850. It still has handwritten cards from the 19th century in its card catalog. This 19th century building is very warm and welcoming, with a children's room below and an inviting first floor and mezzanine. Even better, well-behaved pets are welcome. Anyone can join this membership library. One of the main attractions is the Raven Tour, named for the courtship between Edgar Allan Poe and wealthy widow and library patron Sarah Helen Whitman, which ended in the Athenaeum. There's also a bust of H.P. Lovecraft, one of Providence's most famous literary residents, who lived half a block away. The John Carter Brown Library at Brown University is a haven of silence and antiquarian books. This is what we think of when we think of libraries as temples of learning. On exhibit the day we visited were gorgeous old books and an exhibit called Taming Nature, Gardens in the American Wilderness. Exquisite texts and illustrated garden plans, so important in the early days of our country. Even though it was a holiday week, there were researchers hard at work. This library is an amazing tribute to the power of an individual book collector. The collection began at a time when systematic book collecting around a single historical theme was rare. And although the Brown family had been acquiring books since the early 18th century, the present collection wasn't fully launched until the mid-19th century, when John Carter Brown, who lived from 1797 to 1874, began pursuing Americana. He thought of Americana as the great subject. His son, John Nicholas Brown, who lived from 1861 to 1900, was a collector as well, and he decided to give the library to the world in memory of his father. In his will, he provided funds for an appropriate building and for an endowment. The original library building was formally dedicated in 1904. Across campus, we visited the John Hay Library, named for the Secretary of State, where we admired the legendary Anne S.K. Brown miniature soldier collection on the 3rd floor. It seemed like all the armies of the world were in perfect processional order, in 5,000 tiny little figures. The wife of John Nicholas Brown, Jr., Anne was inspired to collect these tiny figures by a book she'd received as a birthday present, The Wonder Book of Soldiers for Boys and Girls, in 1915. The first floor of the library offered an exhibit that took careful reading, Blooming in the Noise of the Whirlwind, Women Poets from the Harris Collection, showcasing the work of American women from the colonial period to the present moment in beautifully printed books and broadsides. The John Hay Library is also known for its possession of 4 books bound in human skin, called anthropodermic bindings, though they are kept in special collections, so they will be preserved. I'm both glad and sorry we didn't get to see those. And last but not least, we went downtown to the Rhode Island School of Design's Fleet Library, which occupies 2 floors of what was formerly a bank building. Full of great public spaces and private nooks, there was a fabulous exhibit of books about food as art, wittily placed with throw pillows on a terraced reading area, inviting the reader to linger over titles such as Food and Fantasy or The Sausage of the Future. Who could resist? So make it a New Year's resolution to visit a library wherever you go. Make some different family memories. You might be surprised. Here at home, you could check out the new look of the New Orleans Public Library's main branch, or the rebuilt Nora Navarre branch, such an ornament to its neighborhood. The Jefferson Parish Library and the East Baton Rouge Public Library are places we can take pride in as well. And best of all, they're free and open to everyone. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Rory Schmidt and Rosary Hartel O'Neill sign New Orleans Voodoo, A Cultural History, Sunday, January 13th from 2:30 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. Preston Lauterbach discusses and signs Bluff City, The Secret Life of Photographer Ernest Withers, Thursday, January 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. The Dragonfly presents the low-key open mic reading, Friday, January 18th at 8 at the Dragonfly Poetry and Performance Ritual Space, 3921 St. Claude Avenue. Join us for the Tricentennial Reading List every Tuesday at 8:44 a.m. and 5:44 p.m. The Tricentennial Reading List is brought to you by the Hellas Foundation, the John Burton Harter Trust, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.